You're listening to episode 30 of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes or audiobooks.com, you can stop by the Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. There you'll find podcaster interviews, articles, the Gearheart soundtrack, and more. Or you can email me at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter, username TheGearheart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of the Gearheart. Last time on the Gearheart, the shockwaves from the events of the palace downed the Avenger, but Augustus and Maeve escaped with little physical harm. When Cog arrived to rally them under her command, she found Augustus resistant. Can she count on his help? Can they fight together again? Find out on The Gearheart. Nicholas was not used to receiving telegrams at his hideaway. He was not used to receiving telegrams of any variety, and yet, when a slippery black spider landed on his arm and spoke to him, Nicholas felt that he had just been passed a telegram. It said,
"Good day, Nicholas, old sport. Well, 'tis a good day for my partners and me, for we have recently discovered a lucrative new source of employment. You'll be happy to know that the Seeress lies dead as of this very moment, smashed to hopeless bits at the bottom of her chambers. You'll be rather crestfallen to know that she is also our new client through various sundry extenuating circumstances and so forth, and as she is dead, our contract with you is at an end. In pursuing alternative sources of income, however, we have come to an arrangement with her estate in rendering protection to the Andrews boy. You may withhold your congratulations. As you are currently the greatest threat to him, and we are likely headed your way, I thought you should know that your days are at an end. We cannot allow you to live any longer should you pose a threat to him. Now, I hate to murder a former client, especially one as wealthy as yourself, but business is business. In the interest of customer service, however, I am providing you this warning with a hearty message. Sally forth and live on as long as you can. For death waits around every corner. Yours in gratitude, E.G. Wallaby."
Nicholas seized the spider between his index and middle finger and squeezed it until it popped. He carefully inspected the remains, wondering if the insect was poisonous, but knowing it wouldn't matter to a creature like himself. He didn't have to worry about such petty things. Electric torchlight glinted off the pipes of the convergence generator as they ran along the walls, ceilings, and floors of the bombed-out husk of Antonella Manor. It snaked down through vents and crawled into the scorched wood and marble work of the building, spreading without end. The windows took turns, flickering a light like lightning strikes deep into the night as Astrid Blauvelt wrought the engine with her magic. The local Kaldavi had decided to throw a revolution shortly after work began, but the device was almost finished. The glorious revolution of the people distracted her constantly, and Astrid found it distasteful at best. Why should the ants scurry about fretting about who would lead them, when in a few short days there would be no one left alive to lead or be led? She tired of constantly renewing her traps to catch the soldiers that wandered into her house like rats. She only wanted the peace of mind necessary to become one with her great, glorious masterpiece. Deep inside the decaying remains of the estate, Astrid's hammer rang out like the call of a ghost in the darkness. She toiled, day in and day out, laying wiring, expanding, creating, and forging. Her goggles grew thick and misty with the accumulated sweat of days, and Astrid became thin. Her muscles ached. Her eyes throbbed. Her bones complained whenever she changed positions. Sometimes, Astrid forgot to do essential things, like sleeping, eating, and drinking. More than once, she awoke to Nicholas placing her into a soft bed, the shadows flapping about his body like a flock of blackbirds. Each time, exhaustion had overtaken her as she worked, and she would awaken to Nicholas's beautiful cherry blossom eyes. He would calmly explain to her that she could not neglect herself, or she might perish or cause an accident. Astrid did not care that she would perish. She cared that she would disappoint Nicholas. She could not let that happen, and so she made an effort to remember to eat and sleep. She had great difficulty. Astrid saw her situation like a waking dream ever since Nicholas feasted upon her fear. Love and joy made themselves omnipresent in each passing minute as Astrid slipped in and out of lucidity. One moment she would be adjusting the amplifier, stumped on a frequency as the morning sun broke the horizon. The next, she found herself sealing the armor plating on the convergence generator, the rays of the sunset glinting off her welding mask. Astrid's coughing constantly disturbed her toils, and she dimly recognized that she sometimes coughed up blood all over her gloves. The fits started after she became exposed to the direct emissions from the convergence generator the day after Nicholas changed her. There was no reason to worry, though. Nicholas would sire a new civilization, and she would act as its mother. The Genesis would unify them. She bore Nicholas's mark now. Mothers suffer for their children, and Astrid reveled in the fact that Nicholas chose her to make such a sacrifice. Astrid invented the convergence generator, and though Nicholas marveled in its efficiency and purity, she didn't agree. The generator wasn't beautiful. Nicholas was beautiful. Every morning, just as the sun bled watercolor into the sky, she would stop her work to watch from the yard as he stalked to the tallest spire of the forgotten estate. The gloomy powder smoke of the shelled houses and the ripped landscape of the city of Keldenorn could scarcely contain the grace and precision as Nicholas stretched his form before the rising sun. His face, the smooth hue of a porcelain doll, caught the orange of the morning light as it filtered through the curling smoke of the devastated buildings. Then one morning he turned away from the sun and stared down at her with piteous eyes. Nicholas fluttered down to her, landing softly on the pads of bare white feet. Astrid stepped forward and clasped his hands. "How long have you been watching me?" he asked.
"You are a god, Nicholas. Do you know that? I come to watch you every morning,"
said Astrid, her breathy voice creaking in the morning chill.
"For what, then, do you pray, dear Astrid?"
Astrid's eyes drifted. Was he admonishing her? What was the answer he wanted to hear?
"I pray that you are successful, my love."
"Then I am not a god, Astrid. I would answer that prayer for myself, were it in my power,"
said Nicholas, and he pushed past her toward the manse.
"Wait, love, I have something to tell you,"
blurted Astrid, running after him. He stopped, craning his neck to better hear what she had to say.
"Nicholas, I—"
she began, but hesitated.
"I have found something that you should know about the convergence generator."
She wasn't afraid to tell Nicholas of her discovery. She only wanted to put it to him in a way that would make him more pliant to her idea.
"Will it work?"
"Of course. It's not that."
"What else would interest me, Astrid?"
"Targeting exclusion."
Nicholas wore the shadows around his body like a loose cloak, and they draped from his bare, slender shoulders in black curtains, swooping as he turned.
"What is that, Astrid?"
he asked, affixing her eyes with his own pink irises.
"My love, I have found something. I have found a way for you to survive the pulse of the generator intact. In other words, I have found a way for you to survive to see the new world you've worked so hard to create,"
she cried, quivering with excitement. Nicholas's eyes widened, and his lips gave a nearly imperceptible twitch. The shadows, which had hung so loosely only seconds before, clawed their way up his skin to encircle all but his face. They bulged and writhed like a tremendous black anemone, coiling particularly turbulently around his perfect, pale hands. Astrid heard the shuffle of the chain as it caressed the stones of the manor steps, and she wondered if this was the moment that Nicholas would take all of her. Were it not for their mission, she would be glad of it. Astrid wished to help Nicholas in any way she could, and if he chose to eat her right then, so be it.
"Follow me, Astrid," he said, walking into the house.
As they walked down the blasted hallway, Nicholas's eyes darted over the pipes and conduits, ensuring that everything was in its rightful place, poised and ready to fire.
"Astrid," came his smooth voice, though he seemed distracted by his work. "My dearest Astrid, do you understand what I am trying to do?"
"Of course, Nicholas,"
she replied. She would show him her devotion with a quick response.
"My apologies. I have asked a rhetorical question, and one that you cannot answer. A mind cannot be outside of itself, and so how could you understand that you do not understand? Again, I am sorry."
At one time, Astrid would have been upset. She would have defended her statement and explained exactly what Nicholas was trying to do in an effort to show him that she really had listened. However, that defense would have only been motivated by fear of rejection. Instead of doing anything to please Nicholas, she held fast to her faith in his love and waited for him to speak again.
"Please go on. I am listening,"
said Astrid.
"When man first picked up a stick, he beat an animal to death with it. Then he sharpened it to stab. He wanted to survive, of course, so that made sense. How long do you believe it was before he turned a stick upon the man next to him and spilled his blood upon the stones of their community?"
"I don't know,"
she said.
"Of course you don't. No one can, but we can wager a guess. It was not long."
Nicholas made his way up the stairs toward the marble balcony overlooking the main ballroom. He stopped his climb and looked down at Astrid.
"You see, that's the way we were built. We were created with murder in our hearts and blood on our hands. It's simply the way things are."
Nicholas turned back to the stairs and continued his climb.
"My father trained me with a sword and chain. He created me with a purpose, to kill Auden Slade, and in doing so, I was reborn. Some would say that I am a monster, but I would say I am refined. I am honed, I am polished. I am the ultimate incarnation of mankind, born to kill and killing to live."
Astrid saw it now. Nicholas was the apogee of the human race. Even his body was a triumph over nature. When she felt through the gears and mechanical workings beneath his smooth skin, she felt the consummate craftsmanship of his father's hand, and her heart soared. To hear him admit that he was far greater than any human thrilled Astrid to the core. Nicholas said,
"As I fled my father's house into the wild to feed upon the vermin in this world, I realized this indelible truth. But there was something else I realized as well, and I would like you to know what that is, dearest Astrid."
"Tell me,"
she said, turning the corner into the main ballroom. They now overlooked the glittering convergence generator, the white sparks of arcane energies passing over its surface, the seeds of dandelions drifting in the wind. Shafts of sunlight penetrated the roof of the house, pressing against the generator's shining brass with their persistent light.
"Perhaps I am the only one who can do something about this,"
sighed Nicholas.
"So many have come to the same conclusion, that there is nothing good about choosing to be human. Do you know why we must act? Why I have chosen you for this task?"
You have chosen me because I can make the convergence generator, my dearest.
There were any number of people over the last millennium who could have engineered that device, Astrid.
Astrid's pride would have suffered, but she had none. Fear of rejection was the engine of pride, and she needed it no longer.
Then I don't know, Nicholas.
It is because mankind is so close to achieving widespread knowledge of magic, Turtledove. When you were born, how could you have known that it would be the last generation to reach full maturity? How could you have known that you would be taught to make the most important decision that a human can make, to step aside for progress?
Nicholas's eyes positively glowed when he looked down at the convergence generator, its intricate wires sparring with their landscape and forming ordered clusters of glowing nodes.
This is it, my love. Man is about to wrap his hand around magic, the biggest stick in the natural world, and we will be there waiting to take it from him.
You're quite talkative today,
said Astrid, sliding her fingers into the shadows and feeling her way along the bare surface of his shoulders.
I suppose I am, Astrid. I am very excited about the world to come.
Then you want to see it?
Her fingers tightened about his cool skin, and she pressed the tips against the hardened, waxy surface of his body.
No!
He spat, spinning on her. The darkness boiled around him, seeping forward onto Astrid's arms and wrapping her waist and neck.
I have magic. Man has magic. I am everything that is man, and for that hideous sin, I should be the first to die. Nothing can remain of this wicked power, Astrid. Nothing. If even one pathetic, disgusting human is left to wander this planet, everything we have done will just become simple, base murder. We will break the cycle, my love. We will kill, but not of hatred. We will kill, but not to survive. We will kill, that we may create a life worthy of the mantle of existence. I cannot wait any longer, Astrid. It must end.
Nicholas.
Life is a play, my darling, and it is time for another actor to take the stage.
Icy water slapped Keegan's face as his mind stumbled back into consciousness. Icy water slapped Keegan's face as his mind stumbled back into consciousness. The former headmaster looked up, just in time to catch another faceful, as the suited agent doused him again. Frozen chunks scraped and bruised Keegan's face, slamming into the bones of his cheek, his jaw, and his nose. Keegan's mind felt like he'd been beaten with a sack of bricks, and his body corroborated the story. His steely eyes met the agent's again, for the first time since he'd lost consciousness.
"Wakey, wakey, traitor," whispered the agent into Keegan's ear.
"I am awake, you blind little," said Keegan before a fist crashed against his temple.
The world spun briefly before returning to its original orientation.
"What do you want from me? Just kill me already."
Keegan had no idea how much time had passed after he lost consciousness in the hangar below the main house. It could have been hours. It could have been days. Thankfully, he was not awake for the worst of it. When he first awoke in this prison, his hands throbbed. When he looked down, he saw only shattered fingers, each one bearing the distinctive swelling that marked a broken bone. When they first interrogated him, the agents informed him that they used a hammer to perform the procedure that deprived him of his fingers. Keegan did not cry until he was alone again in his cell. The interrogation room bore only sparse furnishings. It held two chairs, one with straps, and one without. Were Keegan in possession of his hands, he would have cast a spell and beaten his interrogator to death with the man's own chair. As it stood, Keegan could only endure punishment after punishment as they continually questioned him.
"Now, where were they going?"
asked the agent, hoisting Keegan forward by the collar. Keegan looked the agent in the eyes, studying him carefully.
"They being,
the former headmaster was rewarded with another sharp slap to the face and flecks of spittle on his neck as the agent screamed into his ear.
They being Jonathan Andrews and that thing he pals around with.
Keegan concentrated on hearing past the ringing in his ear. He didn't want to wince in front of his captor. He grumbled something under his breath.
What was that?
Asked the agent.
I said Fumiston,
said Keegan, a look of shame passing onto his face.
They're in Fumiston, liquidating the chapter house.
The agent pulled out a pair of black leather gloves, with heavy-looking splints sewn into the knuckles, and he slid the accoutrements over his hands.
Really? Because I thought that the Northlander military was there right now, ransacking your place for any trace of where you might be. I know that, because we already sent someone to have a little look-see on your people.
Keegan knew he was lying, but the military was news to him.
Why would the military?
The glove stung Keegan's cheekbones even more than he thought it would, as the agent backhanded him. The former headmaster's vision flashed white, and the agent roared in his face.
Because of the show you and your little traitor initiate put on at the palace last week, you think they weren't watching? They just been waiting to make a move, and you gave them the excuse.
So, it might have been a week. No sooner had this thought crossed Keegan's mind than he was struck again.
I got a mind to gut you right now, Wilkinson,
growled the agent.
Would you kindly?
Asked Keegan.
Nah, I'm just gonna beat the hide off of you.
Then the agent didn't stop beating Keegan until the former headmaster awoke back in his cell. Keegan lay face down in the wet cement. The smell of mildew shoved its way into his head, but that didn't bother him as much as the racking pain shooting across his hands. His nose softly bubbled blood and mucus onto the ground as he exhaled into the darkness. They deprived him of day and time. There were no windows or lights. There was no bed. By this point, Keegan had gotten savvy enough not to groan when he awoke, because that seemed to signal the interrogator that he was ready for more. So, Keegan propped himself up onto his elbows and rolled over. His fingers still screamed out, even though he didn't put any weight on them. So, the Northlander military knew of the Seeker hideout in Fumiston. That couldn't be right. And for what sort of show was Jonathan responsible? What happened while Keegan was unconscious in the hangar? And did the others get away? Surely Augustus escaped. There was no plane to match the Avenger, even among the Seekers. Keegan pondered his questions as he felt his way to the door with only the tips of his throbbing fingers. He was careful not to lean forward, and several times he tripped onto his elbows. He located a tin plate with some cold, tough meat and bread crusts. He wanted to grasp the meat, but his hands wouldn't obey. And so, Keegan bent down and ate like a dog. The old headmaster didn't feel debased or humiliated. He understood his reality. He would find a way to escape. It was then that a voice whispered next to him in the darkness.
So, Professor Keegan Wilkinson,
she said. It was a smooth voice with no accent. She must have been from the Northlands.
How are you feeling?
Keegan sat up and waved his hands in the darkness, not caring if his delicate fingers smashed against another body. He had to know for sure if someone occupied the room with him. No skin, hair, or cloth came to greet the tips of his fingers.
I'm not here, Keegan,
she said.
So, you're in my brain,
said Keegan, his gut tensed. Did they plan to torture him in his cell now? Did they know he was awake?
No, I'm not,
said the voice.
I'm projecting into the room with you. If the guard was to come in right now, he would hear me, and I imagine he would give you a vicious beating.
Keegan found her imaginings amusing. The thought of a beating didn't take much imagination.
You're right. If he didn't shoot me right there because he suspected some escape attempt. Who are you?
I'm the only thing you've got left to believe in, Keegan,
she said. Keegan's lips snarled. He knew the script for this sort of thing. First, a mysterious helper contacts the inmate. Then they plan their escape together. Finally, the escape attempt is foiled by the betrayal of the mysterious helper, leaving the victim psychologically broken after freedom is snatched away. Keegan had seen as much when he served in the Northlander army before his Seeker days. He had friends captured by the Kaldavi, and the Red Herring escape was an old trick.
So, you're going to help me escape then, growled Keegan. Why don't I believe you?
Because that's a common Kaldavi tactic, Professor. But I assure you, this is no trick.
Keegan actually laughed. It hurt, but he laughed hard, choking a bit toward the end.
Oh, well, I have your assurances. How delightful for me. Well, I'm actually quite bored up here, so why don't we get on with it? I'm ready to check out.
The voice didn't seem the slightest bit offended, but she took on an even tone.
Don't be ridiculous, Keegan. I'm the only hope you have right now, real or not. Perhaps you think you can do better by yourself?
I do.
Well, should I leave you to it? I'm sure you're busy.
Keegan's silence made the darkness of the room feel so much more solid. However, he eventually managed to speak back.
What's your name?
Greta,
said the voice.
That's the name I'm going by today.
Well, it's quite pretty, Greta. You've made a nice choice.
Are you flirting with me, Professor?
Asked Greta.
I've nothing better to do. I have to wait until this all plays out, I suppose.
Keegan's empty smile lost its way in the darkened room. He lay down on his side, his shoulder popping ominously as he put his weight upon it.
Your file doesn't say that you're charming, Professor.
Really? I would reciprocate your compliment, but I seem to have misplaced yours amid all of my other papers here, said Keegan,
but a pain shot through his spine like he had just been whipped as the bones settled.
You're only saying that because you're either paid to say it, or because you can't see me right now. I'm anything but charming.
Did they make you wish that you hadn't been captured alive?
Asked Greta.
No, I helped my charges escape. I couldn't have done that without using what little power I had left. What about you? Are you pleased to be speaking with me?
I've nothing better to do,
said Greta with a chuckle.
I'll have to wait until all this plays out, I suppose.
Touché, Greta, said Keegan. You might just make the slow march to my execution a little bit more bearable.
You still don't believe me, then?
Not a word, Greta, but you're still someone to talk to.
Well then,
she began.
While you're wallowing in self-pity, you might consider some light study to be of interest.
Oh, foolish me, said Keegan. I left the library at home. What, pray tell, would I be studying?
Keegan could almost hear her smile.
Did you know that some magi are so dexterous that they can cast spells with their toes? I wonder.
Keegan wondered too, as he stared wide-eyed to where his toes lurked in the darkness.
As Keegan stares into the darkness, he begins to believe in escape. How close are Nicholas and Astrid to firing the convergence generator? And can they be stopped? Find out next time on the Gearheart.
This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Today's podcast has been brought to you by Guillemon Brand Feu de Papier de Toilette, reminding you that luxury toilet paper is one of the finer things in life. Need to wipe but don't want to use that old cowboy napkin? Guillemon Brand Toilet Paper is a cut above, handcrafted with 14-karat gold foil. What's that? Gold is too rough for your pampered caboose? That's why we've used rarefied Chinese silk to stitch that gold onto chinchilla skins with a lining of $100 bills for the softest wipe you've ever felt. So remember, next time you need to clean up and you don't want to wipe your bum with a banknote, think Guillemont. And by Hanslinger & Sons Typewriter Repair, the best typewriter repairman in the Tri-County area. But don't take it from me, here's Bob Hanslinger. Hi, I'm Bob Hanslinger of Hanslinger & Sons Typewriter Repair. We all know that typewriters are an important part of the modern office. Without them, none of us would ever get any work done. After all, who can trust that crazy internet? So, the next time your trusty Royal breaks down, why not call Hanslinger & Sons for all your repair needs? Even if you don't have a typewriter, we can do a lot of other things. Change your light bulbs. Maybe talk to you a little. Even if you just threw out some food that was maybe, you know, 2 days old or less, give us a call, and we would be happy to stop by and, say hi. So, call us. Call us today. Please.
Podcasters all over the world are talking about Metamore City.
You want to know about Metamore City?
J. Daniel Sawyer, author of Predestination and Down from 10.
Take Blade Runner and Dark City. Now mix in The Wizard of Oz with a healthy dose of werewolves, private detectives, telepaths, vampires, demons, cops, criminals. Make everyone a shapeshifter. And then you begin to have an idea.
Philippa Ballantyne, author of Chasing the Bard and Weather Child.
In the layer cake of Metamore City, Chris Lester sets short stories and novels with a cast of characters that you'll fall in love with.
Rick Stringer, creator of Variant Frequencies.
Chris Lester has created a masterpiece here. It is one of the few podcasts that when I listen to it, I say to myself, I wish I had done that.
Mer Lafferty, author of Heaven and Playing for Keeps.
Metamore City is a horrific thrill ride, a gender-bending story of intrigue, betrayal, and love. It has entranced me, and it'll entrance you.
If you like magic, darkness, and technology, this is the podcast novel for you.
The voices are some of the best in podcasting, and the production is second to none.
This podcast novel is both sexy and dangerous.
Dark, beautiful, moody melodrama with a ubiquitous erotic edge and always a sense of wonder.
Come here for yourself as the Parsec Award-winning Metamore City podcast begins its second spellbinding season. Subscribe in iTunes or visit metamorecity.com for more information. That's metamorecity.com.
You're gonna love it.